A History of Faith was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 8, 2006 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Faith and Science. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
My topic is the history of faith. It's a little bit presumptuous of me to speak on the history of faith, so let me just give you a disclaimer to start with, that this is going to be a talk on the history of faith as best I understand it and the little I know about history. I mean, I'm sure somebody who'd actually studied the history of faith would have a lot more to say and a lot different things to say than I do. So this is the history of faith as far as I have delved into it, which is not all that far. I think I have a concept of biblical faith, and I think I understand the way in which our concept of faith has gone wrong. But how we got from there to here, I only have some fragmentary kind of ideas, and that's going to be the basis of what I'm talking about today. So I'm not going to spend any time talking about the biblical concept of faith, because both Charlie and Ron will be developing that in the next 2 days. So I'll leave that to them to do. Only to say this from at the outset, I think there's three essential points about biblical faith that are important for the history of the concept. One, and this will be in your notes, but faith is an essential prerequisite to salvation. That comes from the Bible. Those people who have faith are those people who are going to be saved. And that has, all the conceptions of faith throughout history, I think, have agreed with that and taken that into account and incorporated that in their thinking. Second one, faith pertains to knowledge that has been revealed by God and that pertains to God. I think everybody would agree with that. And thirdly, in some sense, faith is a supernatural gift of God's grace. Now, there's going to be some difference of opinion about exactly the extent to which that's true and what that looks like, but nobody is really ultimately going to disagree that it's a gift of God's grace. Okay, having said that, my contention would be that not just on the concept of faith, but Christian theology in general, what we know of as Christianity today is a synthesis that got forged very, very early, like in the second century, at the end of the first century and the second century, a synthesis that got forged between a biblical worldview and a biblical understanding of reality and what I would call the philosophical prejudices of Greek philosophy, of Greek speculative philosophy. The people that we know of as the church fathers, the people that have come down to us in history as the most important Christian intellectuals of the first two centuries, were enamored with Greek philosophy and Greek culture, as most of the world of their day was. I mean, that was the hip and groovy way to think about things, were Plato and Aristotle and the conversations that they spawned and the worldviews that they were beginning to develop. If you were going to be intellectually respectable, you needed to cast your view of reality in terms that were interesting to people who liked Aristotle and Plato and Greek culture in general. So what happened is, I mean, look at it in our own day. If you look at the church critically, you can begin to see various ways in which we as Christians package our Christianity in a way that's interesting to people in American culture. Never mind whether it's true. Never mind whether it's wise. Never mind whether it's actually the way Christianity is. But in order to sell it to our culture and make it palatable to our culture, we present it to our culture in terms that it can appreciate and value. Well, I think the same phenomenon was happening in the first two centuries of Christianity. these early theologians and philosophers were thinking about their faith in a way that made it palatable to the intellectuals of their age, and that happened to be Greek philosophy and Greek culture. Well, that certainly is the case with respect to the issue of what is faith, I think. And so to understand what they were up against, we need to look at Plato and certain Platonic perspectives on knowledge. So in my notes here, yeah, I think you all have them now. In my notes here, I'm just going to go through a series of tenets that would characterize Plato's teaching. The first thing is the kind of knowledge that you can have of an object is directly correlated to the nature of that object. So a physical thing like a chair, that for someone like Plato, if you understand the Platonic worldview, chairs are not real. What's real is chairness. Now that sounds really, really strange to us in our culture, but it's not quite as strange as it might seem. The point that he's making is that we have a tendency to associate reality with concreteness. If something is concrete and substantive, it's real. If something is not concrete, if it's abstract, it's not real. So if you ask a typical American, is love real? They wouldn't want to answer no, but they have trouble answering yes, because you can stick your hand through love, I think. I mean, it's abstract. Whereas, no problem at all saying the chair is real, because if you kick it, it hurts. What's concrete is real. What's not concrete may or may not be real for us. And that's not the way the Greeks are thinking about this, or Plato is thinking about this. Plato is thinking in terms of permanence. What's permanent is real. What's not permanent is unreal. So the problem with this chair is I can take a blowtorch and a hammer or something, an axe, to this chair and make it no longer be a chair in a matter of seconds. But no blowtorch, no hammer, no nothing is going to make chairness go away. Chairness is eternal. Chairness is here to stay, or at least as long as there are minds to grasp the concept of chairness, chairness remains. So because it's thinking of reality in terms of permanence, chairness is real, chairs are not very real. They're barely real at all. And so Plato thinks in terms of a hierarchy of being, a hierarchy of reality. Chairs are on the border of nothingness, of not being real at all, and then you can sort of climb a ladder of things that are more real and more real and more real until you get to the most real of all, which are the forms, and even they are not as real as what he would call the one, what Aristotle ultimately calls the unmoved mover, and what Christians who are thinking in the tradition of Plato and Aristotle call God. So God is the ultimately real being who is more real than anything else. Yeah, wouldn't that be great? The most real being. Yeah. So just as there's hierarchy of being, hierarchy of reality, there's also hierarchy of the way of knowing. And for Plato, there's a direct correspondence between what it is you know, or what it is the object of your knowledge, and the kind of knowledge that you have of it. So the knowledge that you can have of a chair is, he says, mere, they usually translate it opinion, but that's sort of a misleading translation. It's mere appearance. A chair, you can only have an appearance of a chair. You don't have understanding of a chair. You don't have knowledge of a chair. It only appears to you. And that's the highest form of knowledge you could possibly have of a chair, because it's not very real. And since it's not very real, you can't have substantial knowledge of it. God, on the other hand, being the most real of all beings, the appropriate kind of knowledge, the appropriate level of knowledge for him, is the highest level of knowledge. We'll talk more about that in a second, but the point is simply that you have a hierarchy of knowledge, a hierarchy of reality and being, and they correlate to one another. The lowest form of knowledge corresponds to the lowest form of being. The highest form of knowledge corresponds to the highest form of being. Okay, which brings us to the next point. The higher the form of knowledge, the greater the certainty that is attached to that knowledge. So what is the highest form of knowledge? The highest form of knowledge would be rocks, be characterized by two things: true insight into the essence of that thing, for one, and accompanied by rock-solid certainty. There's just no room for doubt in any knowledge that you would have of God. Now, that one point alone is going to be hugely problematic throughout the whole history of knowledge from then on. Because, well, let me just comment on that. Because the fact of the matter is, I mean, here's what they're thinking. Plato was a mathematician. Geometry was the king of things for Plato. Well, what kind of knowledge do you have in geometry or math or logic? You have, there's this quality to the proposition that 2 plus 2 equals 4, or that the sum of the angles of a triangle is whatever they are. help me. Okay, thank you. Or that if A is true, not A is false. That is, A cannot be not A. We just can't even imagine considering that false, those propositions false. And that's the kind of certainty that Plato kind of adopts as the highest form of knowledge. And there is something wonderful and marvelous and shining about logic and math. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if everything we knew with that kind of necessity, with that kind of certainty? It would be wonderful. But the fact of the matter is, nothing of any importance that we know in life can we possibly know with that kind of certainty. Even something like, as Descartes showed us, even something like my own existence, is it logically possible that I don't exist? Well, it's logically impossible. So I don't have logical certainty about even my own existence. And if I don't have logical certainty about my own existence, do I have true knowledge, real knowledge of my own existence? Well, in Platonic terms, no, you don't. But what is actually the case is the things that are most important to know are the kinds of things that we do not and could not possibly have logical certainty about. The things that we do have logical certainty about are trivial by comparison. So you know that 2 plus 2 is 4. Good. So do the demons, and they don't care. I mean, it just... What we have logical certainty about is the form of things, not the substance of things, not the content of reality, only the form of reality. And the substance of reality, which is really important and what we want to know about, you don't have logical certainty or mathematical certainty about that. But that's what Plato's thinking. If you got to the highest order of being, what kind of knowledge would be appropriate with respect to the highest order of being? Logical and mathematical certainty. And throughout the Middle Ages, that's what they believed they were aiming at. That's what they believed God had promised them. And that's what they believed faith was an aid to, was mathematical and logical certainty about the essence of God, the essence of the ultimate being. Okay? The next thing that's true of Plato's philosophy on knowledge, the highest form of knowledge is an intuitive, direct, immediate, quasi-mystical, intellectual grasp of the essence of the ultimate being. This ultimately finds its way, as I will say later in the notes, in the medieval concept of the beatific vision, is this right out of Plato. So, see, for Plato, there's something imperfect about knowledge that you had to get through by a series of steps. This is A is true, B is true, C is true, D is true, therefore F. that's great, that's all fine, but wouldn't it be more perfect knowledge if you could just know F directly, like that, in this grand flash of a hunch, out of an intuitive insight, where you just know immediately that it's true? Surely that's the highest form of knowledge, especially if it contains certainty along with it. So ultimately, for the medieval philosophers, salvation itself is what they call the beatific vision, which is going to be this grand, immediate, direct, intuitive insight into the knowledge that's in the mind of God himself. To know everything by knowing the mind of God directly and immediately with utter certainty. Can you think of a better thing than that? I mean, that is bliss. That is ultimate happiness. That is ultimate fulfillment of our humanity. And that's what they're thinking with the beatific vision. I'm not sure, well, it's hard to find that in the Bible except with a few proof texts. It seems like it's completely contrary to what the Bible is teaching, but it ruled the day throughout all of medieval philosophy and theology. Every one of them agrees with that. That's our salvation. That's our great hope. That's what we're looking forward to, the beatific vision. Okay, so the ultimate fulfillment of my own humanity is to attain to the highest form of knowledge. Where's that coming from? Well, those of you who've read Aristotle, how does he define a human being? A human being is a rational animal. What is it that makes a human being distinctive among animals? His rationality, primarily. So how are we as a species, if you will? What is it that will fulfill us if our distinctiveness is fulfilled, our rationality is fulfilled? How do you fulfill rationality? With knowledge. So what's ultimately going to fulfill us? When we know all there is to know. That's what will ultimately be our fulfillment, is to know everything that there is to know. Again, very, very unbiblical, very contrary to the spirit and the tone of what the Bible is teaching, but comes straight out of Plato and Aristotle. And if you have imbibed Plato and Aristotle, don't even question it. It makes a ton of sense. Of course that's our fulfillment, because we're rational animals. God made us rational animals in order to fulfill our rationality. And that's what eternal life and salvation and heaven will be, is the final fulfillment of our rationality with knowledge. So the ultimate fulfillment of my own humanity is to attain to the highest form of knowledge. Next point, a more perfect being will and can have a higher form of knowledge, hence a knowledge involving greater certainty and greater perfection. So angels, you saw this in your reading with Aquinas, he would occasionally compare us with angels. In fact, at one point he says, our salvation is when we know like the angels know. Because angels, being a higher form of being, are capable of a higher form of knowledge than we are. Our ordinary human way of knowing is of such a nature that we really can't know as well as we need to know in order to have our rationality fulfilled. So what's required? It's required that God, through his grace, supernaturally enhance our rational abilities in order that we can transcend our ordinary rationality and know like the angels know. He called it becoming deiform, that is, becoming somewhat like God in the way we know. We literally have to have our intellect supercharged by the supervenient grace of God, adding to the faculties, adding to our rational faculties so that we know better than we otherwise could know. Because otherwise, we can't know with the kind of knowledge that will fulfill us. Okay? So, I'm sorry, I mixed up. That was not pure Plato. I anticipated the impact of Plato on Christianity, so this will be a little bit repetitious. But so when we get past the apostles and go through medieval Christianity to the Reformation, what's the concept of faith that's prevailing there? Christianity from the end of the apostolic age to the Reformation was a synthesis of authentic biblical perspectives, bastardized Christian doctrines that were not authentically biblical, and various themes and perspectives that derive from Platonic philosophical perspectives. The perspectives that resulted from this synthesis are these. One, salvation is only given to one who has a right knowledge of God. So notice that I'm not sure that this perspective is altogether coherent. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I just don't grasp the coherence of it. But I think you can see some tensions in this perspective. One of the ways that they conceive of faith and understand faith is that faith is having a right knowledge of God. Normally, we experience that in our experience as being orthodox in our theology, having and believing only orthodox doctrines, only right doctrines, but believing the right creed and holding faithfully to the right creed. That's faith for the medieval Christians. And so you knew a heretic because they had the wrong view of the Trinity, or they had the wrong view of baptism, or they had the wrong view of the sacraments. If you didn't know things exactly the way you were supposed to know them, then you were a heretic, an unbeliever, and were going to go to hell. So salvation is only given to one who has a right knowledge of God, and I should say the things of God. Secondly, salvation is given to the one who has a right knowledge of God because faith is meritorious. Remember in your reading, Aquinas quotes Gregory, that faith is not knowledge, because knowledge can come through ordinary reasoning. And what good is that? Because why should there be any merit in knowing what you can know through reason? Faith has to have merit to it, and ordinary knowledge can't possibly be meritorious, so faith must be other than knowledge. And Aquinas doesn't agree with Gregory's conclusion, but he doesn't really challenge the idea that faith is meritorious. That, yeah, we all know that. There's a merit in having faith. So this view of Christianity seems fundamentally to work with this conception of faith, namely that faith is embracing and adhering to what the church authorities say is right knowledge of the things concerning God. Aquinas, in our reading, virtually gave a definition of faith that was just that, that you have a disposition to accept on divine authority what that authority says is true. That's faith. So that's another way that they're looking at faith. And whether those are coherent or whether that's incoherent, I don't know. But it's, on the one hand, submission to authority, divine authority, but divine authority as mediated through church, church fathers, creed, church councils, and so on. On the one hand, it's submission to divine authority. On the other hand, it's just flat out having the right set of doctrines that you espouse. Now, there's a distinction between a right knowledge of God and faith, however. Right knowledge of God is the ultimate precondition of our salvation. If you don't have the right knowledge of God, you can't be saved. And a perfect knowledge of God is actually what our salvation consists of, the beatific vision, knowing everything that there is to know about God and the things of God and what God knows. So a right knowledge of God is the ultimate precondition of our salvation. Faith, on the other hand, is the means of attaining those aspects of a right knowledge of God that are not available to a person by means of ordinary reasoning and philosophy. It seems to me they have a pretty clear distinction that they're making between knowledge and faith. Knowledge that is attained through reasoning is not faith. It's only knowledge that's attained apart from reasoning that they use the word faith to describe. I think they use that pretty consistently, if I'm not mistaken. And what Aquinas is recognizing is that most men lack the time or the ability or the skill or the inclination to do the necessary philosophical investigation that would be required to attain right knowledge of God. It's only a very few special men, like Thomas Aquinas, who are capable of attaining the greater part of what we rightly need to know about God through philosophy. It's only an elite who have the time and energy and inclination and skill to be able to arrive at a right knowledge of God philosophically. So, for most of mankind, salvation would not be possible if it were not possible to have right knowledge of God by some other means other than philosophy, because most people are not philosophers. And so he says that faith is the means by which most of mankind attains that right knowledge of God. They don't get there through philosophy, they get there through faith. Besides that, because of the weakness of human reason, philosopher and non-philosopher alike. Every philosopher is a human being, and the problem is human intellect is not as good as angelic intellect or divine intellect. So there's an inadequacy in our own intellect itself. So because of the weakness of human reason, no man whatsoever, philosopher or non-philosopher, is capable of attaining all aspects of a right knowledge of God through ordinary reasoning. For example, his favorite example is the Trinity. Who through ordinary reasoning could ever grasp the Trinity, he says. The mystery of the Eucharist. Who through ordinary reasoning could know that the bread isn't bread, that it's really the body of Christ. Or, as Aquinas points out, who through reasoning alone would know that the world had a beginning? I mean, for all we would know through reasoning, it could have been eternal and lasted forever. So how would we know it had a beginning? It's only through faith that we can have that knowledge of what's true in relationship to God. Because our human reasoning is inadequate to get us to everything that we need to know. And besides that, because of the weakness of human reasoning, no man is capable of achieving a sufficiently certain knowledge of God. I mean, even the things that the philosopher can know, he can't know as well with the same kind of clarity and the same kind of certainty that he can when faith has supercharged his intellect. So grace to strengthen the created intellect is necessary in order to achieve certain knowledge of the things that we need to know, the right kind of knowledge of the things that we need to know. And as Aquinas argues, grace is given in proportion to our love for God. So that's why we are to love God and to foster and promote our love of God in this world, because the more we love God, the more grace is given to us. The more grace that is given to us, the greater clarity and certainty with which we know what we need to know and believe what we need to believe. Therefore, for those reasons, faith is a prerequisite to a right knowledge of God for all men. Whether you're a philosopher or a non-philosopher, all men need faith. Ordinary reason in philosophy is, this is probably a comment that's especially true of Aquinas and may not be true of medieval philosophers in general, but ordinary reasoning in philosophy is rationally superior. Hence, the philosophical man is rationally and humanly superior to the non-philosophical man. I'm hardly in agreement with that. But he is not spiritually superior. So faith is the great equalizer in terms of giving us spiritual merit in God's eyes. But just from a purely human point of view, the philosopher is clearly the superior human being because he's the more rational human being. Aristotle would certainly agree with that. So the ultimate kind of knowledge, perfect knowledge, is knowledge of the essence of God, the being who is the ultimate and most perfect being. Now, notice the shift here from biblical Christianity, how strikingly different that is. Knowledge and understanding in biblical terms is to know myself as a creature, to know myself as a sinner, to know my unworthiness before God. It's to know my Creator. It's to know the created reality that I exist in and know it as a created reality. It's multifaceted, it's comprehensive, and the knowledge that the Bible is talking about is not particularly metaphysical and speculative. It's very down to earth. It's about the realities of my own individual human existence. That's what I need to know. That's what I need to understand. Now, granted, I can't know and understand the concrete realities of my ordinary human existence without knowing myself as a creator created by God. But it's so that I can know me here and now in this world concretely. It's not knowing all kinds of esoteric speculative things about who knows what. Thus, the complete lack of interest in the New Testament in angels compared to Aquinas and the medieval theology. Who are angels? Dudes we don't know anything about. That's what they are. I mean, it's not that they don't get mentioned, but you just don't have any sort of real preoccupation with what's the nature of an angel and How do they exist, and do they move? Do they not move? Do they exist in one spot at the same time or everywhere at the same time? All the stuff that the scholastics debated, they don't really care about and are not even at all interested in, because the knowledge is not metaphysical and speculative in nature. And certainly, nowhere in the Bible is it ever even hinted that one day we will know and deeply understand in this certain intuition the very essence of God himself. I'm not even sure we're going to understand the essence of anything, let alone the essence of God himself. That's just not interesting. It's not the essences of things that wisdom consists of. It's the concrete realities of our lives that gives us wisdom, knowing that. Okay, knowledge of God, therefore, will and must involve the highest level of certainty, following straight from Plato. The highest form of knowledge is the highest kind of knowledge of the highest kind of being, and the highest kind of knowledge has to involve certainty. So, any doubt with respect to one's knowledge of or understanding of God would imply that one lacks in one's knowledge of God altogether. If you don't know it with certainty, then you don't know it at all. You don't really have the right kind of knowledge. Again, I would argue that's completely alien to the biblical perspective. Doubt is not the opposite of faith for the Bible. Perfect understanding is a quasi-mystical intuitive grasp of the essence of God. That's the beatific vision. Salvation consists in one's being granted the blessing of the beatific vision. The beatific vision just is salvation, as far as the medieval theologians were concerned. What I accept by faith are necessary prerequisites to my coming to understand, to see the essence of God, but they're just prerequisites to that. Okay, then we come to the Reformation. In the Reformation, we shed many of the Platonic elements of medieval Christianity. We do shed many of them on the one hand, but on the other hand, much of the tradition in the Reformed tradition still retains some of the fragments of those beliefs that the medieval theologians developed. And I'm not sure I have all of them here, but for example, these five things, I think, in one branch of the tradition or another, would still be maintained. Salvation is only given to one who has right knowledge about the things of God. So the emphasis upon confessions and creeds and orthodoxy and right doctrine is still a part of the Reformed tradition. Secondly, faith is when I adhere to what a divine authority tells me to adhere to. Faith, submission to authority, is a spiritual virtue. That's still very much alive and well in the tradition of the Reformers in some quarters. Some elements of right knowledge are incapable of being grasped by reason. They must be accepted by faith. The distinction between knowing by faith and knowing by knowledge, ordinary knowledge, is still a valid distinction for a lot of people after the Reformation. The ultimate salvation of a human being is to be placed in a position wherein he sees and enjoys the knowledge of God, the highest being. Jonathan Edwards is right there. John Piper in our own day is right there. And that this is still being maintained. But it's really not all that different than the beatific vision of medieval philosophy. It's just recast and reformulated, but it's the same old beatific vision all over again. And then finally, doubt and uncertainty as the antithesis of faith. I think you still find people in the Reformed tradition who would maintain, yep, if there's any doubt, then you do not have faith. So to maintain your faith, you must stiff-arm doubt and just keep doubt at arm's length. Don't entertain it at all. So where are we at today? I think today we just have what I mean by today is in the broader Christian culture that we're all a part of. I think we just have this, we don't really have a coherent view of faith. We just have all these fragments that have come down to us through history of kind of snippets of ideas about what faith is that we all hold together in a very incoherent, uncomfortable tension. I don't think most Christians today have a coherent concept of what faith is. We just have these things that we say about it at various times. And here's a list of some of them. Again, faith, I think, for us is adhering to a right set of beliefs for a lot of people. faith is a dogmatic, unwavering, undoubting adherence to that right set of beliefs. So what characterizes faith is the absence of doubt, for example. Faith is an entirely different way to come to knowledge other than ordinary reasoning. So whatever it is, it's not ordinary reasoning. It's another way to come to knowledge. Most notably, it is a way of achieving certainty in my knowledge of the things of God. We would still, a lot of Christians will equate faith and certainty. If you don't have certainty about it, then you don't have faith. So faith is the dogmatic adherence to beliefs due to submission to spiritual authorities. That is to what those spiritual authorities tell me the Bible says. For a lot of people, that's the case, especially if it's a creed or a confession, something. Or faith may be seen as intensely believing the prescribed set of beliefs about God without normal justification. Actually, what I'm giving here are three different ways that you can attain certainty without it being based on ordinary knowledge. One is just dogmatic adherence. Two is believing something intensely. So, you know, you don't just believe, you really believe. When you really believe something, you kind of crowd out uncertainty, at least at a psychological level. Your psychological experience is there's no psychological uncertainty. Or another way of gaining certainty, it's an emotional psychological connection with God or an intuition of God that forms the basis of knowing God with certainty. So it's a direct, immediate intuition into the things I'm supposed to believe. I don't have to think about it. I just immediately see that it's true. And if I can immediately see that it's true, then of course there's no uncertainty in that. Okay? So today's conception of faith involves an incoherent collection of fragments from the history of the concept. The first fragment, faith involves a right set of beliefs. The second fragment, faith precludes all experience of doubt. Faith involves perfect certainty. And the third fragment, faith is a different way of knowing from ordinary reasoning. All three of those are very much, I think, alive and well in various forms for us today. Are we supposed to go to 2:45 or 2:30 or 2:45? Okay, so we have some time for your questions.
On fragment number 3, faith is a different way of knowing from ordinary reasoning. What things do we not about God should we not think that we can reason about? Should we accept on, I don't know how to say it, but blind faith, but
right.
We can't reason. We can't go there with our reasoning abilities.
Well, what I'm trying to maintain is none. Take something like, how often do you see people when you're in a theological discussion and they get to a point and you say, well, I don't understand how those two things go together. Tell me how both those things can be true. And their answer to you is, well, I don't know either. It's a mystery. Well, why do they feel justified in giving you that answer? The reason they feel justified in giving you that answer is because they believe, like Aquinas, that reason can only take you so far in understanding God. And you cross a certain threshold where now you know it by faith. You don't know it by reasoning any longer. And that's okay, because that's what Christianity is all about, is faith. So there's got to be those certain things where I'm going to know them by faith and not by knowledge. Now the problem is, how do you know that the thing that you're knowing by faith is not nonsense? That's the difficulty. And they won't even go there with you. But what I would maintain is, God never ever... Plato invented that distinction. Not even Plato. The medieval philosophers invented that distinction between knowledge and faith. As Schaeffer says that Aquinas introduced the distinction between nature and grace. After our reading today, I understand better what he was talking about that, because in the area of knowledge itself, there's natural knowledge, and then there's the knowledge that happens because of the grace of God, the super added, supercharged intellect that God gives us by his grace. Well, that distinction should never have been made. That anything that there is to know ought to make sense rationally. If it doesn't make sense rationally, a human being ought not to believe it.
Okay, so there are some things, though, about God that we ought not to know. That I think that's what I'm asking. So, like, I take it by faith that God's plan of choosing some and not others is the right thing. But I can't go there rationally. I don't know how to... But maybe that's just something that we're not designed to know.
Okay, yeah. So, but see, you would never say, if someone asks you, do you understand that? You would never say, no, it's a mystery, I don't think. You would just say, I don't know that. That's an area of ignorance for me. It's beyond the scope of my experience, beyond the realm of my knowledge, beyond the realm of my perspective to be able to know. But how do you know when you've reached the boundaries of your perspective? By reason. Right? I mean, when you can't understand the contradiction, it's because reasoning is failing you. And it's because the thing that you're attempting to know is not knowable because it's not even true, because it can't even make any sense. It's reason is failing you. But when I know that I'm ignorant, reason is not failing me. Reason is telling me there's a reason why you can't know that. And I can be comfortable not knowing it because reason itself tells me you have no basis for knowing that. You don't have the requisite experience. You don't have the requisite perspective or whatever. But that's a rational, ignorance is a rational position when there's a reason for the ignorance.
So we just have to work that out individually when we see an issue come up in the faith or a doctrine that people would say, take that by faith, and you don't have the tools to figure it out rationally on your own, but we have to think of it rationally to say, is this an issue that's not really knowable or not?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I'm wondering if I could just draw something on the board and have
sure.
you help me maybe help actually think through that same question again, just a little bit of visual help.
Sure. Are you going to talk as you draw?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll hold the mic.
I found it helpful to think through reason and faith in sort of a limited number of logical possibilities. If we have all elements of faith are also graspable by reason, then we have faith as a kind of subset of reason, typically called rationalism. Or all elements of reason are a subset of faith, typically called fideism. Or reason and faith are mutually exclusive. And this is where it seems, and I may misunderstand Schaefer here, but where he talks about the fact-value split, the two-story house, Nancy Percy writes about that in Total Truth as well, but citing Schaefer. Then there's a view that simply hasn't really been well recorded, that reason and faith are, in fact, just identical things. And I'm not sure that anyone's really held that position or argued much for it. Then there's this position that reason and faith have an interlocking center, but that there are things of faith that are exclusive from reason and elements of reason that are exclusive of faith or that are independent. And I'm just wondering if you could just maybe answer her question again, but kind of helping us, maybe if this helps anyone, it helps me to think through in that kind of paradigm.
Okay, let me ask you a question about this. How would you understand the difference between the rationalism up here and the equation of reason and faith? Is there...
I this is not my own driving. I'm pulling this out of a book on apologetics by Creep and Ticelli, but I think that what you've got is here, whenever we speak of reason and faith, they are completely synonymous terms that that this position would hold. It's a logical possibility that
okay.
they are completely identical. Whereas here, we may say that a person may have faith to arrive at a point, but that point can always be arrived at through reason as well. But that a person may take it on faith that, you know, that the chair will hold me up. Well, I could attend to that. Can be grasped by reason, can be gotten to by faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure how to make that case, but people have made it well, and then there's this division. But
okay, well, I think in these terms, I am advocating rationalism.
Okay.
There's a significant difference between the way faith is normally used and reason. Sorry, giving you feedback. Feedbacking the living daylights out of you. That if we could talk about faith and reason as literally synonymous, if we're not talking about believing in Jesus, believing in God, believing in the stuff that leads to our salvation, then I would argue that these are basically synonymous. I mean, in the history of the Greek language, pistis, the word that's translated faith, just means accepting something is true, affirming that something is true. That's belief, pistis. And how do you do that? Well, normally, through rational, ordinary rationality. You look at the evidence, you look at the arguments, you take the right perspective, and you say, oh, that's true. So normally, those would be synonymous. When it comes to the gospel, and so when Paul says we're justified by faith, he's not saying we're justified by agreeing that it's true that Jesus is the Messiah or that it's true that Jesus raised from the dead, because faith is more than that. It's more than intellectual assent. It's actually intellectual assent accompanied with what I call existential commitment. And what I mean by that is committing my entire life and being to the truth that I affirm that is. So it works its way out in the choices that I make, in the life that I live, in the values that I hold, in the priorities that I adopt. All those values and priorities and choices are informed by the fact that Jesus is the Messiah, that Jesus was raised from the dead, that God is there and he's the rewarder of those who seek him, and so on. I'm not just intellectually affirming them. I'm having my whole life transformed in the light of those things being true. And that's what makes faith faith, is that it's, I don't just believe it. I don't just believe it on the surface of my intellect. I believe it with the depths of my being. So that I would make that distinction between faith and reason. But the intellectual component of faith, I think, is synonymous with reason.
Jack, so going back to Kim's example of the fact that God has said that he has chosen some and not others, and if I understand you right, Kim, you're saying that a portion of that we have to kind of take on faith because it sounds mysterious. And so is another way of saying this, and what you're trying to explain too, Jack, that I have the statements, God has chosen some, but not others. And I can understand that, and I believe that. What God hasn't told me, though, is how he made that choice.
Right.
And that's kind of what I end up taking on faith, and that's mysterious to me.
Okay.
And that it's even good. So the faith aspect of it is that I'm just ignorant about, well, for one thing, the means or the criteria that he used, or just the method that he used to choose some but not others. But if I'm going to believe that it's something that it's good, that actually is a rational choice that I can make because of looking at the examples of God's character in other instances, events, statements that are written about in the Bible. So that's not really something even on faith. I could actually believe that because of these other ways of getting at an understanding of the character of God from other statements and events that I read about in the Bible. But there's certainly, going back to what this issue of, there's just a lot that God hasn't told us about himself and about his way of thinking and about why he does certain things. And that's what a lot of people then talk about as, well, I'm just going to take that on faith. What they're really saying is I just don't know.
Yeah,
and that's the ignorance issue that
right.
you were speaking
about. I mean, I think in that case, I mean, notice that how the medieval theologians define faith as accepting something on the authority of someone saying so. Well, there is some truth to that. I mean, there's a meaningful distinction that you can make between knowing something by reason based on my own circumstances and my own experience versus believing something because somebody else tells me so. If you want to say that's faith, that's fine, but don't pit it against reason. You see what I'm saying? Because believing something on the authority of someone else is either a rational choice or an irrational choice. If I have good reason to trust them, then it's part of reasoning. It's part of rationality. If I don't have good reason to trust them, there's no virtue in my trusting them. Take the goodness of election. What if some philosopher, some clever philosopher, more clever than I, could come along and prove to you that it was utterly inconsistent with moral goodness for God to do that in this knock down conclusive proof? Well, then I shouldn't accept it by faith that God is good. I should reject it if that were the case. Now, I don't think there is any such argument. I think it can be shown that there's no reason. There's no reason to come to the necessary conclusion. Only an evil God would choose some and condemn others. I don't think that follows. But if it did, the people who advocate faith as another way of coming to knowledge would say, well, I know that the philosopher has proved that only a evil God would do that, but by faith we believe that God is good anyway. Well, I think that's irresponsible. I think that would be immoral. I don't think there's anything virtuous about that.
Did you just say that we should believe the philosopher because he showed rationally?
Well, I'm sorry, only if, not because the philosopher is the philosopher, but hypothetically, if his argument was rock solid rational.
See, this is a problem for me because, I'm sort of sympathetic with the faith just because some of us less educated people, me, the only one in the room, but, I would have to say at that point, there were times reading The Most Real Being where I was like, is this right? You know, like I'm being led. I think, well, he could convince me something else. And I don't have enough skill with logic to see that this might be wrong. And so by faith, I would rather, I mean, that's a bad example of Most Real Being, but something like that, where someone could lay out a proof for me saying that, well, your God is actually a bad God because he's chosen some and not others. Well, it seems like I would go, I'm not going to go there. And I know that here it says you should follow truth wherever it leads, but how do I know that that's true if it's just logical proof?
Okay, but you say I'm not going to go there. But we can loosely say by faith I'm going to believe he's good anyway. But I'll just bet you it's for reasons that you're not going to go there. Don't you
think?
Yeah,
that's right.
I mean, your own experience plays into that. Other things that you know, other things that you've thought about. That is, his proof may sound compelling in the sense that you can't find any flaws in his proof, but the conclusion just doesn't make sense in the light of everything else that you are already convinced of and you already know. Well, that's being rational, to reject the proof as over against everything else that you know. I mean, we're not supposed to believe every proof just because it's a proof. We need to always check our proofs and make sure we're not being tricked, make sure it's not a specious argument, make sure that there aren't some debater's tricks that's tripping me up. There aren't any proofs that really prove anything of any importance because there's too much room to move in the premises of any of those arguments. I mean, I have yet to see a proof that is actually compelling in philosophy.
And I think it gets stuck in my head with the definition of reason just being logic instead of kind of the way it's been redefined.
Yeah, is Polanyi tomorrow? One of the things, Polanyi was one of the most important books I ever read in my life. I mean, it's had the biggest impact on me because what he did is that he expanded for me what falls in the category of reason and rationality. you know, we're so accustomed to thinking reasoning is a syllogism or a Euclidean proof of some kind, and that's reasoning, and everything else is something else. But Polanyi is making room for hunches, intuitions, inarticulate insights, insights that we can't even tell one another what it is I know. And that, but that's still reason. It's still an intelligent human being having those insights and having those intuitions and having those hunches. And that's valid, warranted knowledge. Well, that's huge. That's really important to have a big enough concept of reason that we leave room for all the real ways that we know what we know, and that not just artificially narrow it down to what a few egghead philosophers do because it's the only thing they can do. Okay.
Okay.